Unfortunately, Rockpoint himself was the only one of Caleb and Charlian's senior naval officers who was part of the inner circle. Getting some of the others on board was a high priority, but again, not something which could be rushed. Rockpoint himself had argued strongly in favor of adding High Admiral Brian Locke Island to the list, and both he and Merlin were confident that the Brethren of Saint-Gernot would approve Locke Island's admission quite soon. Of course, the question then arose of just who would inform Locke Island. With Caleb, Charlian, and Archbishop Michael all out of Old Caris, it would be virtually impossible to find the right messenger, somebody with the authority to make Locke Island listen if he didn't take it well, and somebody he'd trust enough to believe when he did listen. Baron Wave Thunder might serve in a case of dire emergency, but still.
"I could probably talk Brian into sending me instead of Gwillem," the Baron said after a moment, but his expression was unhappy and his tone was tentative. "No," Merlin shook his head again. "Caleb and Charlian are right about that. We need you right where you are, too, or rather where you're about to be. And let's face it, Dolar's a worry, but Taro's right next door, and White Ford is no slouch either." It was Rockpoint's turn to grimace, but he couldn't disagree. The Imperial Carizian Navy was the largest, most powerful fleet any single Safeholdian realm had ever boasted. It was rising rapidly to a strength of over 90 galleons, and it continued to expand. Unfortunately, it wasn't going to find itself matched against any other single Safeholdian realm. It was going to face the combined fleets of virtually every mainland realm. Worse, the Church of God Awaiting had poured out staggering sums to subsidize those fleets, although not all of the various kingdoms and empires' building programs were equally advanced. The Temple Lands and the more northern ports of the Harchong Empire were considerably behind the shipyards of Dolar and the Desnarian Empire, but that situation wasn't going to improve for the Church anytime soon. But the plain ugly truth was that even with an unlimited budget, which it didn't have, the Carizian Empire couldn't possibly have matched the mainland realm's combined building capacity. Nor was the Carizian supply of manpower unlimited either. 90 galleons, each with a crew of roughly 500, required 45,000 men. So far, the Navy had managed to meet its manpower requirements without resorting to impressment of its own, largely because it had always followed policies similar to the ones Thirsk had forced upon Dolar and the Church. That was about to change, however, because there were only so many volunteers who could be attracted, no matter what the inducement, and the manning situation was only going to get worse as the size of the fleet continued to climb. And it was going to have to climb. Assuming the Church completed its current construction programs, it would command a fleet of over 390 galleons, better than four times the current Carizian strength. 150 of them would be converted merchant ships, but so were a quarter of the Carizian Navy's galleons. And that didn't even consider the 200-plus galleys the Church had built before it realized just how outclassed galleys had become. They might not be well-suited to decisive broadside duels, but they more than doubled the total number of hulls the Church could throw at its opponents. And if they were free to operate while the Church's galleons neutralized Caris's galleons... The good news was that the ships in question were scattered between five widely separated navies. No single kingdom or empire could match the Carizian's numbers, although Harchong would come close once its winter-delayed construction could be completed. Concentrating those widely dispersed squadrons would be at least as difficult as it had been to concentrate the forces detailed for the Group of Four's original plans for Old Caris's destruction. And even after they were concentrated, their companies would be sadly inexperienced compared to the Imperial Navy's crews.
Earl Thirsk, at least, obviously recognized that fact. So did Gavin Martin, the Baron of Whiteford, King Gorja of Taro's senior admiral. Unfortunately, from the Church's perspective, there were only two fleet commanders still available to it who had ever faced the Carizian Navy in battle. The Earl of Blackwater, the Coruscantian commander at Darko Sound, had died there, and Garth Ralston, the Earl of Mandir, and Sir Luke Coleman, the Earl of Sharpfield, who had commanded the Emeraldian and the Chisomian components of Blackwater's fleet, were now in Carizian service. Even more unfortunately for the Church, the fact that Thirsk and Whiteford had been devastatingly defeated by then Crown Prince Caleb had caused their advice to be discounted by almost all of their fellow flag officers. That was clearly changing in Thirsk's case, but neither Harchong, nor the Desnarian Empire, nor the Temple Lands seemed overly inclined to profit by Dolar's example. Taro did, but King Gorja continued to languish under a cloud of disapproval. It seemed clear that the group of four continued to blame Taro for the disastrous intelligence leak, which had permitted King Harald of Karas and his son to deduce the Church's strategy and come up with a counter-strategy to defeat it in detail. That was grossly unfair, although with no knowledge of Merlin Snark's, it was understandable enough, particularly given Karras's efforts to encourage exactly that reaction. As a consequence, none of the Church's galley fleet had been laid down in Taroisian shipyards. Following the Group of Four's belated switch to a galleon-based fleet, Taro had been admitted to the building program, yet even then the Taroisian component remained the smallest of all. And Whiteford, who was quite possibly an even better combat commander than Thirsk, had been almost totally ignored.